The following commentary does not necessarily reflect the views of the staff and management of WBCA or Boston Neighborhood Network. If you would like to express another opinion, you can address your comments to Boston Neighborhood Network, 3025 Washington Street, Boston, Massachusetts, 02119. To arrange a time for your own commentary, you can call WBCA at 617-708-3241, or you can email radio@bnntv.org.
Hello, and welcome to Bostonian Rap. My name is Rachel Meiselman, and you are listening to me on WBCA LP 102.9 FM Boston. This is Boston's community radio station. So as always, there's a lot of things to unpack, so we'll just dive right on in. Now, of course, today is election day, and so we will shortly find out here in Boston the candidates, the two mayoral candidates that will move forward to November. And then, of course, the November vote will determine who our next mayor is. And then for the city council races, that large seats, there are 17 candidates, so a lot. The top eight will be moving on to November. And then, of course, because we have four at-large seats, the top four of those eight will be our at-large councilors for the next term. Then, of course, you have some district races. You have District 7, which is also very crowded. The top two will move on from there. District 4, the top two will move on from there. District 6, the top two will move on from there. So it's very, very crowded. And I believe District 9 will find out who is. There are only two candidates there. So I think what might happen is that the final vote will be in November. So if it's just two candidates, you vote in November. District 1 is unopposed. District 2, there are two people, so that'll be determined. I believe it's two people to be determined in November. And then I think there might be like one or two other seats that where it's unopposed. So Councillor Flynn, he's running unopposed. He's an incredible counselor. So, I look forward to seeing him serve another term and benefit not only his constituency, but, the city, Bostonians throughout the city. Then, of course, District 1, that is held by Lydia Edwards, and she's running unopposed. So you have Councillor Baker, who I believe is just one other candidate, Stephen McBride. That'll be determined in November, as I said. And then you have, I'm trying to think, District 6. I said that was, the top two. That's currently held by Matt O'Malley. And he is stepping down. So that'll be kind of sad because I quite like Matt. And he's been a very soothing. He's been a very soothing and reassuring presence on the Boston City Council. And I think that in a city that has been so devastated by the pandemic, and that had been, prior to the pandemic, hurting so very much in so many ways, a presence like Matt's is going to be sorely missed, because Matt doesn't really, not at all. He doesn't get into
partisan politics. He just does his job, and he, you know, undoubtedly has ideas and causes that are dear to him, but they don't supersede the needs and concerns of his constituency. He understands that there's a place for activism, and it shouldn't be, you know, any activist activity shouldn't be intertwined with that of a public servant, because, you know, an activist and activism by you know, their very definitions, they point to a very specific cause or causes and agendas. And again, no one's going to fault a public servant for having issues that are dear to him or her. That's normal. I mean, presumably that's, you know, those are the reasons why that person actually, or those people actually stood up and run. But the issue is when again, those causes become the sole focus of the public servant while he or she's in office. And then we can't have any more of that. So let's talk about this mayoral race. I've expressed my disappointment with the candidates. It's a very real disappointment because, you know, there have been, you know, 8 mayoral candidates, and 3 of them have been completely ignored. And we've just focused on 5, 4 of the 5 are women. And it's, and of course, you know, all along, those 4 women were leading in the polls. And, you know, I expressed this on previous shows, and I'm going to reiterate it. And I also expressed it on social media. I very strongly resent being dictated to. I don't like when people tell me what I need to have. And I have been told what I need to have, and that is a female mayor. And more specifically, a female mayor of color. And more specifically, a female mayor of color that, if she doesn't swing left, at the very least, she is willing to throw a few bones to the political left. And, you know, again, it's identity politics. And yes, it angers me. As a feminist, as a woman of color, yes, it does anger me. And that might come as a surprise to some people. That is, if they didn't know how I think and if they weren't aware of my politics. But it's, I'm never going to stop saying that I would like to see more women elected. I mean, when I was running for Congress, you know, I've shared how very tough it was, you know, and I remember thinking to myself more than once, I did my undergraduate work at Harvard. Charlie Baker did too. Charlie Baker, though, has never had to stand up and explain himself the way I have. I remember thinking that, well, gee, surely my Harvard degree is carries the same weight as that of Charlie's. And this isn't actually a criticism against Charlie, because it's not Charlie's fault that is the way things are. But I had to prove that I am someone to be taken seriously. And I had to work so very hard, whereas Charlie has always ever had to just simply walk into a room and people say, I take you seriously. And I mentioned the same thing about Kevin O'Connor, who ran for U.S. Senate. And I think, I mean, Kevin O'Connor is, he's great. He's great. He's just a really approachable guy, affable. He was backed by both flanks of the party and a lot of people in between. That put me off, but then that's more me than him, because I'm, I'm this rebel here, and I already explained my relationship, my perspective on the establishment. I think that it is an infrastructure within which one can get a tremendous amount of good done. But it's also an infrastructure within which one is overwhelmingly, more often than not, expected to show blind loyalty. And the establishment, in terms of composition, it's, there are a lot of yes men, and that's not who and what I am. But getting back to Kevin O'Connor, very nice man, but he never had to prove anything. He didn't have to. He didn't have to prove that he was a serious candidate for U.S. Senate. He just stood up and declared his candidacy and filed the necessary paperwork, and he was taken seriously. And it was unfortunate, painfully so, that people who knew me, other Republicans who knew me and knew what I was capable of, knew that I wouldn't have stood up had I not thought that I could actually be a competent congresswoman, congressperson, they still did not want to look at me through as a serious candidate. They did not want to look at me through a lens of equality. The same way that they looked at Kevin or Charlie Baker, they didn't want to look at me the same way. And I think about all the things that I talked about that are still so very dear to me, Methadone Mile, the schools, the condition of the Boston schools, but just education in general, food insecurity, affordable housing, what does that actually mean? Really kind of targeting that word affordable so it has meaning, especially to those who actually do need require affordable housing. What we can do to make sure that we have more of those units, more buildings that do offer people possibilities to stay in the city. Working, benefits, the gig economy, being underemployed. And these are issues that I've been talking about a very long time. Very long time. So I talked about all these issues, and guess what? They're all front and center. They're all front and center. They have been front and center in the Boston mayoral race, and they will be right through November for some time to come. And they're being discussed in other parts of the 7th Congressional District and beyond. And yet, as a woman, and yes, a woman of color, there was great reluctance to take me seriously. Now, the person that was recruited to run against me, Rayla Campbell, she had not had any political experience at all, had never even volunteered on a campaign at any level of government, had no real discernible experience that would speak to the role of congressperson, and she certainly had ample opportunity to kind of connect the dots for people, but just never did it, never saw the need. And that was interesting for me. So she never saw the need. And the thing is, this isn't me trying to disparage Ms. Campbell. This is just making a statement of fact. And, you know, I actually, you know, looked at her candidacy and I said to myself, not as someone who is running also for the Republican nomination, also hoping to get on the ballot, to challenge Ayanna Pressley. But I was actually looking at it with a different set of eyes. So I was looking at it as that of a consultant. And I said, you know what? I could see where Rayla Campbell's, just on the face of it, without knowing Ms. Campbell, that it could be an attractive candidacy. The fact that she didn't have any political experience, as long as she showed an understanding of the government and how it works and the responsibilities of the role of a congressperson, sure. It could have been, you know, presented as someone who was outside the system, you know, someone just like you, a mom of three young children, wife, who just was very unhappy with the way things were going, the direction in which her town was going, the district in which she was living going, the direction in which the whole of the Commonwealth was going. And so she thought that, you know, with her sensibilities and concerns and her ideas, her passion would best benefit the people if she were a congressperson. Like, I could see that. You know, here she is, a mother of three young children. She wants to make sure that her children are well educated. She's concerned about what's being taught in schools. You know, she had, for however long she worked as a dental assistant, or maybe did some, you know, worked for some medical offices, maybe doing, you know, maybe as an office manager. Maybe she was also one of those people that when you called in, you know, call center for medical practice, she helped you process your claim. So I think that was kind of, you know, those, you know, that was her professional background. And so she could have taken all that and said, you know, I see that we need better medical coverage. But instead of the federal government just saying one size fits all, let's look at how we can make it more tailored to the people. And let's look at who would be best able to do that. Do we really want the federal government in the business of the healthcare business? You know, and again, just, you know, I'm Rayla Campbell. I'm just like you. She could have gone, she could have said all of that, and I would have said, you know what? Okay. But she didn't do any of that. She didn't have any ideas. She didn't have any, well, she had my ideas. she didn't have much of a platform. She didn't have any platform. She was just like a strong black conservative woman that was going to fight that power to be. And it's like, well, you have to know how government works in order to be able to do that. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the reason why I'm mentioning Rayla Campbell is because I noticed something. I said, notwithstanding her incredible lack of experience and her ability to articulate how government functions and what in her professional and educational background would enable her to do the job, she was taken seriously. Very seriously. And why? because she was backed by the establishment. She was backed by Jim Lyons. And so I look at what I, you know, what I've seen, what I've experienced firsthand before my run, I think, and then I think about the experiences I had during my run. And let me tell you something. I definitely want to see more women neglected, and certainly women of color. And then when I see people actually articulating that in so many words that they can't distinguish one woman of color from another, how offensive, how remarkably ignorant and racist is that? That people couldn't tell the difference between me and Rayla Campbell and one of the purveyors of that nasty, ugly narrative is actually running for mayor of Somerville, William Toro. And I think Somerville is a phenomenal city. It really is. And I lived there for a few months in the 90s. And it was just great. It was great. People are, you know, the lifers are wonderful. And you do have people who have put down roots in Somerville, and, you know, they're quite lovely too. So you do have a nice mix. You know, members of the left that are intransigent, and they're, some of them are in Somerville and Boston and just different places throughout the Commonwealth, you know, in different cities and towns and states throughout the nation, they make things difficult. They make things difficult. But you know, the lifers and, you know, the people who put down roots and who understand, who've taken the time to understand Somerville's unique culture and have wanted to make it even better, it makes for a really nice experience when you go to Somerville. Then, in the 90s, when I was there, and now. But, you know, as it currently stands, you have a lot of people on the left, on the intransigent left, and they're not working for the benefit of all the residents of Somerville. And Somerville needs to have more diversity. There absolutely has to be more diversity, intellectually speaking and politically speaking, in Somerville. And unfortunately, you have Bill Toro, William Toro, running as that alternative to the intransigent left, the intolerant left. And I'm sorry for Somerville, because just because he has an R after his name doesn't make him a good candidate. The fact that he thought it was appropriate, that he thought it was palatable to help push the idea that women of color are interchangeable, that are indistinguishable one from the other, that's appalling. That's disgusting. You know, and then, of course, if you look at, so, I mean, good luck to Somerville. I wish the best for Somerville, because, again, it's a tremendous place. They have a lot of great businesses, a lot of great people, and I just wish they had other alternatives to the hard left, other alternatives besides William Toro. And I'll leave it there. I can comment on that more later, but you know, in other shows. But I'll leave that there. But to get back to the point of, you know, the sexism and the racism, you know, we've seen that in this Boston mayoral race. Supporters of Kim Janey leaning on Andrea Campbell to get out of the race. You know, people looking at these two as if, you know, they're pretty much, yes, interchangeable. I mean, are you serious? Like, really, you can't look at Andrea Campbell excuse me, Andrea Campbell, you can't look at Ms. Campbell and Kim Cheney, Ms. Cheney, and see the big differences. You think that they're interchangeable, really? That, you know, one is a substitute for the other? That's horrible. It's incredible for all the talk that we have about race that we have such attitudes that would nonetheless be prevalent. You know, and Michelle Wu also heard, you know, remarks, or I heard remarks about, well, I'm sure, you know, if I heard them, Michelle heard them necessarily, right? You know, especially since they're about her. Well, Michelle Wu, Janet Wu, are you serious? Like, just like, come on. Janet Wu is a very well-respected reporter, a longtime reporter, journalist. Michelle is a politician. They are different ages. They don't look alike. Come on. And so, again, I come back to, yes, I want to see more women elected, women of color elected. But here's the thing. They shouldn't be elected because men, capable, competent men, have been expected or pressured to step aside. And I've expressed that sentiment before. And that's why this mayoral race has not felt right for me. This is why I have not felt good about what I'm seeing, what I've seen. You know, the men in this race, they should have gotten more attention. John Santiago, I'm sad. I was saddened that he suspended his campaign. It's just John Barros. Why isn't John Barros getting more attention? You know, it's just, it's not right. It's not a good path to go down. It's a slippery slope. You know, I find it ironic. And let me preface what I'm about to say with this. I appreciate that I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but I do try to be respectful and I'm consistent. And let me talk about what that means. So the same people, a lot of the same people who are with me, standing with me on the exam schools that have been standing with me, they resent, support diversity, but they don't support engaging in social engineering to bring that about. That's not the way forward. And of course, I've said many times, on many occasions, very publicly, that when it comes to the exam schools, what people need to understand is that admission to one of those three exam schools represents the culmination of not only hard work, but a certain acquisition of knowledge. That is to say, you have to have a foundation in place to be able to be admitted to one of those three schools and then actually have a chance of finishing it, thriving and flourishing while you're there. You can't just place someone in there that does not have the foundation and expect someone to then flourish, suddenly become a great student, to be able to answer the questions on issues, on topics, in subjects that they've never been taught, or they haven't, you know, they haven't had all the information that others have had. So again, that's that, you know, talking about the exam school, that's a whole other topic. Another topic that I could spend a whole entire show on. But the reason, again, why I bring that up is because my group, my, you know, my camp, we're against social engineering to bring about diversity. But a lot of those same people, and you know, let me say this, they're good people. They're not the racists that, I mean, Ricardo Arroyo, I don't know what he's doing, what he, you know, where he's coming from, but, you know, we're not white supremacists. I mean, he's been very vocal in his criticism of my camp, my, you know, my group, and for the position that we've taken. We're not white supremacists. We're not racist. We're not against diversity, right? But the point is that, you know, this group, a lot of really good people against social engineering. But then a lot of them, a good number of them, are going to be supporting Anissa. So Anissa, just like, you know, the other women in this race, they are running in a race that has been engineered to favor them. And I guess that's my thing. I want diversity in my elected officials too. But I don't want social engineering to be the way, the path down which we travel to get there. Am I saying that the female candidates in this race can't do the job? I'm not saying that. I can speak to that in another show. And doing kind of in the aftermath, when, you know, when the results are in, when, you know, the results are in November, we can, you know, sit down and do an analysis. But here I'm not saying any one of the candidates, male or female or male, you know, I'm not, you know, but we're focusing on women here because of the subject. I'm not saying that they can't do it. That's not what I'm saying in the show. I'm saying that they shouldn't be where they are through social engineering, and that I'm sorry, but I can't get past that. And so here I am, a feminist, but for me, feminism doesn't mean that I'm more equal than men. It means that when and where possible, I want the same access to resources and opportunities. And if I stand up and present myself for a position that I have the skill set to do, I want to be looked upon with the same level of regard that a man would receive if he stood up for the same position, the same job. So I don't know what to say. I get emotional when I talk about Boston, because I love this city, because this city has been very good to several bloodlines. I mean, you know, certainly the Meiselman family, but my grandmother was a Fine and her mother was a Glass. And, you know, those two bloodlines, you know, run through me. And it's Boston's been a place where my family has been able to live without fear of persecution, has been able to, previous generations have been able to acquire wealth. We talk about generational wealth, and that's what we've had. It's been passed down. I mean, I've had incredible educational opportunities. I graduated from the Robert Gould Shaw Middle School, and I had fantastic teachers. I'm a very proud alumna of the Robert Gould Shaw Middle School. Excuse me. Long week. It just began, but it's long. And, you know, then, of course, Boston Latin School, I'm a very proud alumna, and I've had, amazing, incredible opportunities there, too. So I do get emotional when I speak about Boston. It's very much, I consider it a love story. And so I want the very best for the city, for everyone here, whether they like me or not. I want the very best for the whole of the 7th Congressional District, and of course the whole of the Commonwealth. But I think the way forward, we've got to, I mean, I can do every show where I start and end it with saying, but it's we got to dispense with identity politics. We got to look at character. We got to look at record. We got to look at platform. And I know I sound wonderfully naive. And speaking of Boston Latin School, I had a teacher in high school, Mr. Berger, wonderful, wonderful man. And he taught me French. And he told my father that Rachel likes to see the world through rose-colored glasses. And I suppose I do. So many years later, I suppose I do. But I would qualify that and say that I'm aware of the potential that this city, that this whole congressional district has. And I just want to see that promise fulfilled. And I don't think that it's ever going to happen if we focus on who can check the most boxes. And, I remain convinced that politics is a way to do a great amount of good. But at the moment, we just have a number of phenomena, elements that I think make the political arena more corrupt and more ineffective than usual. So let me move on to talking about Methadone Mile. I want to talk about Methadone Mile again. But I think what I'll do is first I'm going to take a quick break. For those of you who are just tuning in, my name is Rachel Meiselman, and you're listening to me on Bostonian Rap, which airs on WBCA LP 102.9 FM Boston, Boston's community radio station. So, yes, a quick break, I think, is definitely in order. But when we come back, we are going to talk about Methadone Mile.
Potential is everywhere. It's in every child, in every community.
Big Brothers Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts works to transform communities by empowering, defending, and igniting the potential of youth across Eastern Massachusetts, ensuring every child has the support from caring adults that they need for healthy development and success in life. Big Brothers Big Sisters fosters one-to-one mentoring relationships between child and adult, helping the youth in our communities achieve their fullest potential. But at any given moment, there are hundreds of children in our region in need of a caring adult role model.
Do you have what it takes to become a defender of potential? You can learn more at massbaybigs.org.
If you are struggling to afford your internet bills during the pandemic, there's a temporary government program that may be able to help. It's called the Emergency Broadband Benefit, and it provides up to a $50 monthly discount on your broadband bill to qualifying households. Find more information about the program, including if you qualify and how to enroll, at fcc.gov/broadbandbenefit or call toll-free at 833-511-0311. That's 833-511-0311.
Are you a veteran, or do you know a veteran who is struggling with housing due to COVID-19? Veterans Inc. can help provide support services, including assistance with rent, deposits, utilities, as well as emergency housing, including hotel stays to eligible struggling veterans. If you or someone you know is in need of services, please call 1-800-482-2565. Or go online to www.veteransinc.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Bostonian Wrap. I am Rachel Meiselman, and you are listening to me on WBCA LP 102.9 FM Boston, Boston's community radio station. So, before splitting, before going to break, I said that I wanted to talk about Methanol Mile, and I do. I talked about it at length in the last show. I, of course, spoke about it a little in the show before that. It's going to be an ongoing topic for me because, for me, it represents so much of what's wrong. It represents incompetence. It represents apathy. You know, Kim Janey had said that she is going to her plan, you know, was, okay, I'm going to look at the task force. I'm going to revamp it because, of course, there was the report, which I spoke about. There was a report on the task force that had been assembled by Mayor Walsh, Secretary of Labor Walsh now, that was supposed to tackle Methanol Mile. And, you know, Acting Mayor Janey said, well, okay, I'm going to revamp that because, you know, this report said that, you know, there was a feeling of frustration. There was a feeling of almost like helplessness. And it just, the general sentiment was, is that the task force was, it was just kind of a complete waste of time. And I don't know. When I heard that, I kind of just said to myself, huh? I find that, you know, whether it's Methanol Mile, and let me just make a more general remark first. Whether it's regarding Methanol Mile or really any topic, we put people on a task force, a commission, in a group because of his or her ability to say yes on cue. We only work with bobbleheads. In Boston, it's particularly bad. Okay, so we have a climate where if you say yes and you can clamber high enough up the political food chain, you're going to get put on task force or that, you know, as I said, that commission or that study group, regardless of your ability to actually get anything done, regardless of any kind of knowledge that you actually might have on the subject. Now, there could be someone that has a lot more knowledge than you who could actually move, you know, the group forward, help move the group forward in so far as finding that solution. But that person might never find his or her way on that task force or whatever body we're talking about, if he or she is not appropriately connected, if he or she is not seen as someone who is going to nod his or her head on cue affirmatively, you know, nod his head affirmatively. And I have a tremendous problem with that. And so we wonder why nothing works. We wonder why things fall apart. We wonder why we're having all these problems. We wonder why, despite all the talk, there's no movement forward. Well, that's because we're only putting people in places to make a difference if those people are not going to cause any waves. People are so afraid of others causing waves. And by causing waves, I mean someone who's just going to say no. And quite frankly, that makes me sick. That disgusts me. You know, all the talk about diversity, and it never includes intellectual, political, or economic, for that matter. And it's just, it has to stop. If we have a group and everyone thinks the same way, and those people individually haven't really been able to do much of anything, and they haven't shown any kind of indication of having a superior knowledge about a subject, you know, vis-a-vis maybe someone else. Well, what's going to happen if you put all these people together? Collectively, they're not going to be any more effective. Now, to be fair, there were some people on that task force, or there are, that do have a great deal of knowledge, that do have some insight, but, you know, having a knowledgeable, competent task force, and that's every member, that's just part of it. Because then what you need to have is other partners that are willing to move the recommendations of the task force forward. And there just has to be a real will. Like these task force, these study groups, these different bodies that are assembled in government, regardless of the level, a lot of times they just seem, they're just for show. It's saying, hey, look, I did something. You know, I mean, Ayanna Pressley, we have huge problems with public transportation, particularly in the 7th Congressional District. You know, what has she done? She's, you know, I believe she founded, she's one of the co-founders of a transportation caucus. Okay, but Ms. Pressley, Congresswoman Pressley, actually rides the T. She's very familiar with the T. Before being a congresswoman, she, of course, was a city councilor for a great number of years. And I have to say, nothing's been done. You know, so, you know, there's still delays. There's still breakdowns. And without addressing traffic, which is actually a lot of that is really very much beyond the MBTA's control, to be fair. Yet it impacts the T so greatly, the MBTA so greatly, people's ability to get to work. You know, the bus drivers, they can't magically, you know, drive over all the traffic. I mean, it's an issue. And then you have some of the train lines that, you know, they travel above ground. So, you know, most notably, you have the B branch of the Green Line. And when you have a red light, well, the train has to stop. When you have a green light, the train has to go. So it's, you know, nothing's been done about the traffic. No movement has been made there. And again, you know, we've taken several steps backward, you know, with the Delta variant. Having said that, there's still now a lot of cars on the road. And the T, when you ride it now, we call it, for those who are not familiar with the public transportation system in Massachusetts, we call the MBTA, we call it, for short, we say the T. MBTA becomes the T. We call it the T. And you can actually, if you go to different train stops, you can actually see, you know, there'll be a metal pole with a globe with literally the letter T in it. So you're like, oh, okay, there's a T stop. You know, that's what we say. You know, but the pre-pandemic conditions have returned. And so, you know, nothing has been done to really address the issues that we had before the pandemic just kind of wreaked havoc. So I'm just wondering, you know, what is the purpose of the Transportation Caucus? And then I get back to, you know, this point, you know, about a methadone mile. What was the point of the task force? You know, you have to do more than assemble a body. And I have to say at this point, if there are any politicians out there and any activists who don't understand that the problem has gotten so bad that now we're well beyond we've got to do something like yesterday about methadone mile. I mean, the elected official, I have to wonder about his overall competence and knowledge of the issues in other areas. And as for the activists, especially the ones that focus primarily on methadone mile, they're making the situation worse and they have no business talking. And in fact, I'll say this, you know, because we're getting ready to, you know, sign off on another show. But, you know, you have some people now and they've assembled this great noise machine. And on method, you know, in regard to methadone mile. And so now, if there are any interviews, if there are any comments that are needed for an article, these people have become, they've set themselves up because they have assembled this noise machine as, you know, the go-to person, you know, one of the go-to people. And the thing is, what I'm finding with some of them is they don't really know what they're talking about. I know one person actually from the area, has a relative in the area. But her ability to talk independently about the whole ecosystem, that is methadone mile, it's been very limited. And a lot of what she does and says is just basically a rehash. And she says the same things. And she gets a pass because a lot of the journalists, quite frankly, covering methadone mile have been sloppy and lazy. How many times are we going to read about a stabbing or an overdose? We know. But the conversation has to be moved forward. So then you have these go-to people, not all of whom need to be go-to people. In fact, they shouldn't be considered voices at all, given their inability to talk extensively and coherently about the whole multidimensional crisis that is methadone mile. They have no need to do anything other than say the same things. Oh, well, it's so unfortunate. And what can we do? And everyone deserves to be comfortable. And oh, this is enough. Enough. I'm going to tell you that now we have more than one methadone mile. And I'm going to be talking about that more. But I think that moving forward, I mean, I always do try to be hopeful. I do think Boston can be saved. I think the 7th Congressional District can flourish. I think the whole of Massachusetts can flourish. But I think that it's going to take people being very much more engaged and a lot more willing to ask themselves, what kind of community do we want? And also ask of people who stand up to run, what can you do, given this is how I want to live, what can you do to enable me to be able to do that? So that's all I have time for today, unfortunately. As always, it's been really cool hanging out. Hang out with me next week, and I'll have a lot more to unpack. So this has been Rachel Meiselman on Bostonian Rap. Bye-bye for now.
The preceding commentary does not reflect the views of the staff and management of WBCA or the Boston Neighborhood Network. If you would like to express another opinion, you can address your comments to the Boston Neighborhood Network at 3025 Washington Street, Boston, Mass. 02119, attention WBCALP 102.9 FM. If you would like to arrange a time for your own commentary, call WBCA at 617-708-3241 or email us at radio@bnntv.org.